This is the Bristol Cable.
You only have to look at the money we've squandered on trying to scope out a Bristol Underground. That's never going to happen. And that money should have been put on actual feasible, tangible transport improvements. That's just madness.
I'm Neil Maggs, and this is Bristol Unpacked, speaking to fascinating Bristolians on topics where others may fear to tread. Brought to you by the city's community-owned media, the Bristol Cable. In this episode of Bristol Unpacked, it's election specials again, and we talk to Mark Weston. He is the group leader for the Bristol Conservatives and represents the Hembury and Brentry ward. Enjoy. Hello, Mark.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you? You're sat in your... Is that your office?
It's my kitchen, which doubles as my office. Yeah, no, I'm fine. I have my cup of tea ready. I'm all good.
You're in Brentry, yeah? Is that right?
I am, yeah. I live in Brentry Lane.
So that's the area that you're councillor for. I spoke to the Liberal Democrat leader, Josh Clark, last week. She also lives in the ward in which she represents. That's becoming a little bit rarer now, isn't it, in local politics? Quite a lot of councillors, or a little bit like they do with MPs, being sort of crowbarred into areas a bit. Are you noticing that?
It does happen upon occasion. I mean, I'm not too precious on it. It very much depends on who the candidate is. And so long as they get stuck in locally and really go to bat for local residents, and I don't think it matters too much where they live. The advantage of living in the ward, though, is that people see me when I wander to the shops, the pub, school, library, you know, because you're around more, which also means you can sometimes take an hour and a half to get a pint of milk.
Yeah, exactly. It has its, I'm just thinking that if you're trying to switch off and you're with your family or your friends and everyone's coming up to you moaning about stuff that's going on in the local area or praising you, either way, that can probably be a bit like being famous, isn't it? I imagine.
Well, I think, considering we're politicians, it's more infamous.
Infamous, yeah. Who do you think's hated most, politicians or journalists?
There's that age old joke, you know, what's the difference between a politician and a shark? One's a terrifying killing machine that would eat its own young, and the other's a big fish. And the same joke works for bankers, for journalists, lawyers.
I think it does. Although I see myself as more of a dolphin, I think. Maybe a swordfish.
Indeed.
Yeah. So, local elections around the corner, May the 2nd. Let's just talk about you before. I know you had your manifesto launch at the SS Great Britain a couple of weeks ago. Your campaign launch, and we'll go into that in a little bit. Before that, just about you. How long have you been the leader of the Bristol Conservatives?
2014, I think I took over.
Quite a while, then. Would you be the longest serving main party leader then? You would, wouldn't you, I think?
Yeah. No, I mean, I was first elected in 2006. So when I was first elected, I was a young, fresh-faced 25-year-old. And now I'm old, gnarly. I look around the chamber now and I realize I'm one of the old guard. It's kind of terrifying. At the age of 43, I'm officially the old guard.
Wow. Oh, so you were the young, upcoming, budding shark in the what was then the council house, which is now City Hall then. You've seen a lot of comings and goings and changes then in that period.
I have. Not as many as some of my colleagues, but yeah. So Councillor Richard Eddy of Bishopsworth, for example, one of ours, he was actually there when we had the committee system last time. So for Richard, it went committee system, cabinet and leader, mayor, and now committee. So he's actually gone through the whole spectrum.
Wow. And a lot of people, and I think a lot of residents in Bristol, dare I say, because I had quite a shift and change in demographic in the last sort of 5 years or so.
Yeah.
Most of them don't really know what it was like under a committee system in Bristol and perhaps see it as something that's a bit utopian in response to how some feel that the mayoralty has gone.
Yeah, potentially. Everything changes. I mean, as a fascinating, one of our aldermen, Peter Abraham, he was a councillor in the 60s. He only stood down in 1921. And so you think of the spectrum of all the political changes that has happened over his period. It was phenomenal. He saw everything. Yeah. But for the committee system itself, it's going to be different. We're going to have to see how that works. The mayoral model, I think, failed just because it wasn't all that responsive, wasn't all that democratic. I think its big problem was that the egos, essentially.
The egos of both mayors?
Yes, I would say both mayors, up to George to a lesser extent. Even though I didn't agree with old George, he did often try and take the chamber with him. But that's one of the problems. The mayoral model was flawed because there was no accountability within the system. Now moving to a committee system isn't my preferred model. I prefer cabinet and leader, a bit like South Gloss or Bath and North East Somerset, North Somerset had. But we're going to see how this one works. I hope it will be better. I hope it'll be more consensual. I hope we'll take more people with us. The risk on the model is, of course, it's not as dynamic. People will need to make decisions because, unlike the mayor or cabinet leader, it can be a bit foggy on exactly who's in charge. Well, the answer is we're all in charge. We all have to be responsible, be grown-ups, and actually take part in that decision.
But you will be nominated. There will be a nominated lead
for each party,
and then you will all vote for a nominated lead of the council, which will represent you on the WECA meetings and for the media on certain things. Is that correct?
Yeah. So a lot of it will depend on whether it's a hung council or it's a majority. But let's imagine for the moment it's a majority council. So one party has a clear majority. At that point, they will have the leader, deputy leader, and probably the chairs of the committees as well. So it'll work a bit like that. If there's no overall control, then it's a bit like, you know, in other councils, there has to be a negotiation or a deal done, and we'll see how that all works out.
Yeah. And how was the atmosphere and what was it like in the last big meeting at City Hall, the sort of final speech from the outgoing mayor, Marvin Rees? What was it like?
Forgettable. I actually don't even remember what he said, I'm afraid.
Oh, okay. Right.
Marvin's a good one for telling us all we need to, you know, play nice, behave, be respectful, and then the very next sentence, having a go at us all for various things. I don't think Marvin is going to be missed in the chamber, to be honest.
No. Could he be missed by the electorate, given that he won twice?
He did win twice, but then the city also voted to get rid of the entire position. So I suspect some of the electorate will miss him. I don't think it'll be a majority.
What was the position on the mayoral referendum for the Conservatives? Because obviously I remember interviewing the mayoral candidate who actually stood on a ticket of trying to remove
Alistair Watson,
that's right, to remove the position, even though it was obviously a Conservative idea in the first place. And what I thought was interesting is that the Liberal Democrats did the same. The Greens didn't with Sandy Hall Riven, and there was no sort of noises about trying to change the system or vote for a referendum until they lost. And then a few months later, obviously, a deal was struck with the Lib Dems and it came to a motion and we are where we are now.
Yeah, funny that.
I suppose, for the Tories, says you were consistent, I guess, is my point.
Yes, we do try to be. We don't always succeed, but we do try.
Yeah.
Our preference, the one we wanted, we actually would have preferred a cabinet and leader model. We tried to get that through council. That failed. And then the Greens sort of had some conversion and then they proposed the committee system. Now, of the three options that we could have, you can have one, which is the mayoral model, two is the cabinet leader, and third is the committee.
Yeah.
Our preference is the second one, but we agree the committee system is better than the mayoral. So on that basis that not ideal, but better, we went with that.
What was your critique of the Greens switching? Were you quite cynical about why?
Well, I think in your question to me earlier, I intimated that one, that they didn't suddenly want to get rid of the position until they didn't win the position. But I'll let them answer on that one.
That's politics, I guess. Yeah, that's politics. You've been around a long time. You know how it works.
Yeah, my worry on the committee system, though, does actually hinge to a certain extent on how the Greens do operate. They don't have an internal whip system, so there's no block voting, which can make it very hard to reach consensus, because let's imagine there are 25 Green councillors, which there are, that's 25 separate groups in effect.
Sure.
Because you have to get each of them to agree in turn. The danger, I think, with a lot of all this is we set politics up to be incredibly adversarial. So things like hustings and debates and head-to-head.
Yeah.
And I tell you, that's not how we try and work in council where possible. Where possible, we do actually try and find what common ground we've got between the four main parties and almost bank that common ground. If we agree to here, right, that's fine. And then we'll row about the bit above it. But we do try and get consensus where possible. And especially when you're working on scrutiny committees, I'm hoping that will carry over, that we'll still be respectful of each other and try and get...
I can't say that's how it plays out in social media or plays out in the media itself or in the full council meetings. It seems quite toxic at times.
It can be. And I'm happy to say one of the nice things about Henbury and Braintree, the politics up here isn't actually that toxic. There isn't, the social media itself, there are complaints and things like that, but it tends not to be of a political nature, which I quite like. Other areas in the city I know are quite vitriolic, but I think there's something to be said an awful lot about trying to fight for free speech. And free speech is the right to disagree and disagree politely and just accept that sometimes people just disagree with you.
Have you seen a change in that in politics in the city in your time, where it's become a bit more, a bit more tribal?
I wouldn't necessarily say tribal. I think toxic is probably
toxic. Okay,
the term I go with that.
Where's that coming from?
This wide rise in social media. So in 2006, when I started as a councillor, weirdly, it's one of those things, a lot of my casework came by letter. Old-fashioned letter. And then email came in, and then social media's come in. And the ability to bounce back instantly with responses and replies and that echo chamber, that's probably what's changed, I think, quite fundamentally in the last 20 years.
The Green Party seems to be recruiting quite a lot of people that are campaigning on social media to even stand for councillor in this election. Have you noticed?
No, I haven't gone through all their potted histories of every of their candidates, though. So I'm afraid that's where the journalism comes in. So good digging there.
Just on that, and I do want to talk a little bit about Braintree actually shortly, but just on the sort of Green Party surge, why do you think that has happened?
Well, probably several reasons. I think probably because people are thinking more about the environment than they used to. So that does lend itself to Green Party politics. Also, there had been, you talked earlier on about the Lib Dem surge. There was certainly a protest, say, party voting bloc that appeared. They weren't happy with Conservatives or Labour, so they were looking for another option. And for a while, that was the Lib Dems. Now it seems to be the Greens. So I think it's probably a combination of those. Let's not do it down. The Greens do also have some good local councillors that do get stuck in. I think all parties have some good local councillors that get stuck in. So I wouldn't want to downplay that role as well.
That's quite fair.
Consensual from me.
Yeah, I was going to say that's quite a fair analysis. I've put that similar question to people in the Labour Party. Certainly at the last election, it was all about Bristol becoming gentrified, people coming in from the city, real Bristolians being pushed out to the edge of the city, and actually that this sort of Tories on bikes, almost blaming the electorate for being wrong.
In fact, I think the only difference between a Green councillor and a Conservative councillor is the presence of a bike.
Yeah. Maybe a beard and long as well.
Oh, how dare you? You should go talk to Councillor Graham Morrison Stockwood. That man has got a fine, bushy beard.
It's interesting, isn't it? I think it's like anything, it's multifaceted. I do think what is interesting is, and you kind of hinted at that a bit, is how much of this is about the Green Party itself. How much of it perhaps is a reaction to some of the Labour dominance? Perhaps how is it a reaction to the changes in the National Labour Party, which has obviously shifted quite a bit from Corbyn to Starmer? And I think perhaps the Greens mopping up some sort of lapsed Corbynistas a little bit. And I also think that, particularly in that inner ring, if you look at the seats that you hold as the Conservative Party, they do tend to be in more... traditional areas of the city where you probably will find more, dare I say, homegrown Bristolian, born and bred people that have been here for quite some time. Would that be fair?
A little. I have to be quite careful here because I was actually born on Merseyside. So,
oh, were you? Oh, my God, really? I didn't realise that. Where were you? Liverpool or Everton?
Everton.
Oh, really? Good. Well done.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, who thought? Yeah. So for us, it's a race to fight relegation.
Well, Christ, where's the Scouse accent gone, Mark?
Well, I'm from the Wirral. So the Wirral's basically got two bits to it. One bit of it's Birkenhead, which has a Scouse accent. And the other bit's got more of a Cheshire accent, which is sort of...
Is that Bromborough? Is it Bromborough? Is that what it's called that way?
Bromborough's the other side. Yeah, I'm West Derby, Greasby, Frankby.
Oh, that's the posh bit, isn't it? It's towards Cheshire. It's
I think we're called Woollybacks, I think is the term for it. Okay. But anyway, so I'm from there. No, we do tend to hold, our seats tend to be in the suburbs. It's sort of a reflection possibly in where our politics are, that we are more pro-car, for example, than a lot of the other parties. Yeah. but actually representing the outer areas of the city where you can't have a 15-minute community or neighborhood because things are more dispersed. It's possibly why I chuckled when the only difference between us and the Greens is the presence of a bike.
Well, you can't be a Tory on a bike, really, if you live in Brentree and you work in the town centre, can you? If you've got four kids and you need to drop them off to school in the morning before you go into work.
They'd have to be very understanding and cuddle up a lot.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. So Brentree, Henbury, traditional working class areas of the city, what kind of challenges do people face there? What are the kind of burning issues of your area?
Well, I imagine they're probably the same issues that a lot of other places have. There's issues in common, which is bin collections, which are a nightmare at the moment, it has to be said. Potholes, another nightmare at the moment. Then there's also local services, parks maintenance, road maintenance, schools, housing. These kind of bridge, I suspect, almost all wards, and they're probably everywhere. We then sort of have our own unique circumstances. Because we're right on the edge of the city, obviously your viewers can't see it, but the South Gloss border is about 500 metres that way. We have that unique or semi-unique that a lot of the things that happen to us come from a different council area.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
So that's one of the problems. So traffic flowing to and from Cribbs passes straight through my ward. So there's that kind of issue that does spill into us. So if they're doing road works up by Cribbs Causeway, then the traffic tails back all through our area. So there's things like that. We've also got ones where we're still pushing for the new train station. We've got the Bristol Arena is being built, for example, in Brentree. So there's knock-on effects on that. And we have the beautiful joy of having the Blaze Estate in the ward. Obviously means you have a lot of parking problems that come from that, but the estate is beautiful.
Did you support the arena?
I mean, to be honest, I think it probably would have been better in the city centre, but it is quite exciting to see it come in the ward. So I'm looking forward to that, and I hope it opens soon. I think they're talking about 2 years from now, but they're actually working on it at the moment. I met with YTL in February just to get an update on that.
So you kind of support it now?
Wholeheartedly. The one caveat for that is that we're going to, and in fairness, YTL have been very good about this, and that it was part of their planning consent. Where it is, what we don't want is all the neighborhood around it to get slammed with cars. So, what they have to do is they're going to be assessing the parking in the Charlton Mead Drive, Chakesall Drive area before it opens. And then after it opens, they come back and assess just to make sure that it's not getting overloaded. If it does, they're going to have to look at things like a residence parking scheme, but they pay for it. So that's quite good. In fairness, to get from those two estates to the arena, you actually have to do quite a dog leg of a walk. So that's a couple of miles walk to get around it. But no, we are quite looking forward to it.
You are. And will you get free tickets? Is that the deal as the complimentary tickets as part of the arrangement with YTL?
Not that I've heard of.
No. Oh, well, I would be. If I was a local council, I'd be angling. I'm good at angling for free tickets anyway.
I'm sure journalists will get free tickets. I've not heard of anything like that.
I always pretend I'm going to write an article on something and never do when I go to these things. Before we move on, I want to talk about national politics because I do think that will have an impact a little bit on what's going to happen in May here. But also, you stood for Police Crime Commission, didn't you, in 2016?
Yes, I did,
yeah.
I stood for Police Crime Commission in 2016. I also stood in 2019 general election for Bristol North West. So I've had a crack at that as well.
It must be quite a sort of thankless task standing as a parliamentary candidate in Bristol. But as you say, the surrounding areas of Bristol, you know, South Gloss, North Somerset, quite a strong Conservative, but Bristol's, you know, we've been, other than that one seat, been Labour, isn't it? You know, whether that's the mayor, whether that's the Metro mayor, obviously we had a Conservative one before, but it's quite a tough place to be a politician and a Conservative.
Yes, it is. I mean, I would always say it's tough to be a politician anyway, regardless of party, because if you're doing your job right, you're almost always on call 24/7. I've had phone calls on Christmas Day with issues. So it can be a bit tough. But I don't think you should necessarily sympathize with us too much. We volunteer for this. I have almost respect for anyone that puts their hat in the ring. It's very easy, I think, to sit on the side and throw stones. It's very different to get down there and actually see what you can do to make a difference. And I think any time an election comes along, there will be good, hardworking politicians and councillors and MPs that lose despite all the good work they did. And we've seen this before.
Do you think that's been forgotten a little bit in the last few years and not the role of the councillor not respected enough by the mayoral team?
I mean, the mayor didn't respect the councillors at all. So I suppose to an extent, but I'm not really bothered by that, that the mayor's position ceases to exist in under 3 weeks.
But the value in city, made a point around whatever the party, you would respect people that, in your own words, get stuck in and do things in their community to be valued, not just in their position, but be valued as a voice that reflects their local community. Because if the charge is, like you just said, that councillors weren't listened to or respected by the mayor, that's not listening to councillors, is it? That's not listening to the people that they represent?
No, to be clear on it, I don't think the mayor respects councillors very much, but the public, I think, do genuinely respect people that try and help. And I think if you're genuine and you're actually trying to make a difference, regardless of the political party you stem from, I think the public do resonate to that. They understand. I think public are very clever. They do suss out fakes and phonies. So I think even if you lose, because that's just the way the democratic process works, I think people still do appreciate someone that tries.
Mm.
Enthusiasm covers all manner of sin.
Can you sniff them out in the chamber as well, Mark?
What?
The phonies?
I couldn't possibly comment.
No? Well, I need names. Tell me.
No.
Let's talk a little bit about national picture. Obviously, the last election in 2019, huge majority, the biggest Conservative majority since 1979. It's all gone a bit wrong since then, hasn't it? If the polls are true, we're looking at the one I saw this morning, Labour with 458 seats and the Tories with 90, when obviously you won 365 before. Well, what's happened? How's it gone so wrong?
I always love it when politicians are put in this position. So here you go. I'm going to give you the standard response that you'll get from all of them. Yeah. Polls are a snapshot in time. So we're going to have to see what happens when the general election fully cooks off. Mm-hmm. At that point, the media will start focusing on actually what all the parties are standing for. Mm-hmm. And I'll be brutally honest, I have no idea what Keir Starmer stands for at all. So I think they're going to have to make a decision when they get to that point, when they're in the polling booth or they've got the postcode letter, and look at, with all the media attention on a general election, or media attention on policies, performance, etc., then we'll make a decision. Because I think an awful lot of what we're seeing at the moment is Conservative voters are now moving into the unsure column, and it's going to be our job to try and get them back voting for us.
Why are they unsure, Mark?
I think they're unsure because we've been in government for 14 years. So that does lend itself to it. I think that they just want to see the Conservatives doing a good job. And over the last few years, there have been a lot of pressures, COVID, inflation, etc. I still think we're not doing a bad job. And we're going to have to see if we can convince enough people in the general election. I think we can. And I'll certainly be trying to do that as we move into the election period.
You think you can win?
My election out of the way first.
But you think you can win the general election?
I hope so.
You think so?
I said, I hope so.
I know you did. I know that. Do you think so? Forget about hope. Of course you're going to hope that, aren't you? Everyone's going to hope it, isn't they?
No, I think we can. We're just going to have to work darn hard, and we have to prove our point. And I think we're going to have to lay out our manifesto in front of the electorate, and Labour are going to have to lay out theirs as well. And we're going to see how that all translates.
You're right. Polls are just a snapshot of where we're at the moment, and they have been wrong. They were wrong over Brexit. They were probably wrong in 2017 election as well. But if the polls are as bad as they are now, there's also a reason for that. How much of the current polls are because voters felt cheated, really?
Well,
because obviously there's a lot of the red wall kind of lended votes, or people that voted for the Tories for the first time ever in some communities since the 1930s, that people felt really emboldened, and then maybe just felt after Partygate and everything that went on,
you're asking a question that I honestly can't answer, which is possibly strange, because when I'm knocking on doors at the moment, I'm talking to people in Henry Brentshire or wherever I'm campaigning. We're actually talking about local issues. So I've got a feel for what people think about locally and
but not nationally. No. Does that not come up then? Yeah. But I guess you would, if I was a Conservative strategist, a local Conservative strategist for you, I would be saying, whatever you do, keep the conversation about local. Don't take it national, because obviously at the moment there have been a lot of issues, and if that doesn't come up, then of course that's fine, and maybe it's not massively relevant.
It comes up now and again, but not very often. Actually, more when we're knocking on doors at the moment, because it is a local election, and the local leaflets are all talking about parks, potholes, and all the rest of it.
Yeah,
it is very much our conversations sit about the local issues. So it doesn't tend to stray into the national and international all that much. It is very much a case of what locally are you going to do? So that's actually where it's going. So I probably can't answer your question, but that's not because I don't want to. It's because we haven't moved into a general election where we're trying.
Do you have an instinct? I mean, I do think that you can't always completely divorce the national picture. There will be successes nationally in Labour seats in some of those areas I've spoken about, which will be reflected a little bit in the national picture. You can't always divorce the two completely.
No, we can't. And I suspect that whatever's happening nationally is going to filter into the local election results as well.
Yeah.
But from what we're trying to do on the door and where we're, the conversations we're having, it is keeping it local because these are Bristol elections. So it's talking about what's happening to Bristol, what we would like to see happen in our communities and Bristol. So that's where, that's the conversations we're having at the moment.
For sure. I will get on to that. I'm just also just interested, whether you'd have those conversations, but also what you feel yourself, really. I think what's quite interesting is the same people that voted for Boris Johnson in that huge majority, obviously were not the people that voted to get rid of him. They were voted to get rid of, you know, the same way that Thatcher was, really, by their own MPs. And whether some people might feel, yes, I've been let down by the Partygate stuff, but I've saw a lot of stuff on social media, conservative supporters feeling angry, actually. And we are now seeing, you were angry, okay.
I mean, Partygate really hacked me off because, you know, not being funny, my wife's epileptic. So actually, the whole lockdown and everything else happened, induced seizures because the stresses and things in my family. So absolutely, very cross. It wasn't actually Partygate that finished Boris off, though. It was the Chris Pincher issue that took.
Yeah, you're right. That was the kind of final nail in the coffin. You're right. Yeah.
When Partygate happened, we were really annoyed. However, the Ukraine war then started, and love or hate Boris, actually on Ukraine,
he was
very good on the Ukraine war. I mean, we were actually supplying and training Ukrainians before it became fashionable. So actually, he did do well there. The problem was then Chris Pincher came along and he got caught out on Chris Pincher. Yeah. And at that point, his MP colleagues went, we're done.
But that was obviously an accumulation of things that maybe in isolation, that probably wouldn't have become a kind of sacking. So were you annoyed that the party got rid of him or not?
No, I think, to be honest, although I liked Boris as an individual, I think at that point his position had become untenable at that time.
Yeah. Okay. So we are where we are now. I saw, did you see Liz Truss's interview yesterday on Radio 4?
I haven't. I saw some of the comments earlier on. But I haven't.
What's your feeling about that? She's doubling down a bit and trying to sort of reinvent herself, isn't she?
I've only seen some of the comments. I haven't seen the whole thing. Yeah. So I probably can't comment because I haven't read the whole thing on it. The one I saw this morning was she endorsed Trump.
Yeah, she did. She did. And they're not standing in Bristol, actually, are they? Which is interesting. The Reform Party are gathering a bit of momentum. And a lot of sort of lapsed Tories that feel a bit angry about what's happened, that you haven't got Brexit done in the way that they require or haven't been tough enough on migration, are kind of heading in that direction a little bit.
Potentially. And this is the thing that I think the party needs to set out its stall. But what I would say, that this parties do get challenged quite rightly, and they have no inherent right to someone's vote. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that always got me whenever other parties tried to do a deal, and we saw it. You know, in the last elections, where Greens and Liberals and all that tried to do a deal, you can't just en masse take someone's vote for granted that they're going to go X, Y, and Z. It's up to each party to earn that vote, and that includes the Conservatives. So they're going to have to lay out their stall, show they're competent, get on with the job, and try and prove to people that maybe are looking at other parties that we're worthy of their support. And that counts actually locally in local wards and local elections where we want the residents to support us. But also counts nationally. It's our job to earn that vote.
Sure. Right, let's talk local. I know you're dying to do that. Let's read a quote from you, Councillor Mark Weston.
Oh, Lord.
The Labour Party have failed Bristol. Their deeply unpopular mayor and administration have overseen a broad decline of our brilliant city. Their unjust war on motorists has increased pressure on small businesses and those on lower incomes, while their complete failure to maintain basic services like buses, roads or send services have left local people in a state of disrepair. If elected, a large cohort of Conservative councillors will be committed to improving citywide services in neglected parts of the city and our suburbs, not left behind, that are not left behind to go to rot and ruin. That's quite strong words, Mark.
You'd think there was an election going on, wouldn't you?
Wouldn't you? Yeah. So they failed. So what have they failed in?
I think they've just wasted too much money on too many grand projects, which actually the money would have been better spent on getting the basic services right. And you only have to look at the money we've squandered on trying to scope out of Bristol Underground. That's never going to happen. And that money should have been put on actual feasible, tangible, realistic transport improvements. You then look at the tens of millions that got thrown at the Bristol Engine Company. That's just madness. I mean, that money is vital to what it is now. And they think, look at what's happening in special educational needs. We've got a planning department at the city council that the government's having to intervene on. You've got a clean air zone at the moment that was brought in that includes the Portway, even though the Portway air pollution isn't at the illegal levels. There are all manner of things that they have done that have hurt.
So you would push back. You could also include Bristol Beacon in that, I guess, as well.
Bristol Beacon is a complete mess, to be honest.
So they've been bad. That's one of the criticisms of Labour by the Conservatives generally, isn't it? That fiscally, Labour waste money. And do you think this administration has been very wasteful?
Yes.
You do. Right,
Like an answer to be for?
No, that's fine. That's fine. And when they obviously they talk a lot about austerity and being hamstrung by national government, and we have seen a reduction significantly in budgets for local councils, which comes from a Conservative government, and they do say that a lot. And there is validity to that. But you would accept that?
Well, I mean, the budget's definitely lower than it was. But when you have a reduced budget, you have a responsibility to spend the money you've got wisely, and all too often they don't. And to be honest about it, what I think the problem here is the city needs to do the basic better. So it's about things like getting the potholes repaired properly. It's about proper parks maintenance, having a planning department that works. It's the little things. They may not be sexy. They may not have the big banners on it. But if you don't have a properly functioning licensing team or neighborhood enforcement team or a planning department, pothole repairs, et cetera, weed killer, you kill the weeds in the pavement. If we don't get these things right, quickly, the city starts to degrade. And
these are all public services that you're talking about.
Yeah, and they're not getting them right.
You sound like a Labour. So you're criticising a Labour administration for big, I think you said big vanity projects in the same article, where people are wasting money and they're not focusing on public services. That's a strange thing that you've got a Conservative councillor accusing the Labour Party of not delivering on public services and spending sort of too much. And
I think what you've got is a Conservative councillor accusing Labour of spending money inappropriately. I'd say that's probably a tradition that's gone back 100 years. But you've got to get the basics right. At the moment, it isn't happening like that. And I realise that they'll throw all manner of things at me. That's absolutely fine. But you only have to walk around my community and walk around communities across the city to know the truth in this.
Yeah. Should the Tories be giving more money to local councils?
I mean, in an ideal world, I'd love the budget to go up. I genuinely would. The problem we've got, and I think there's actually got to be a grown-up conversation with the country at large, is there is only so much money. And we have to look at all of the competing pressures. The NHS budget, the education budget, these are all vital as well. So I think, although I would love to promise more money to local government, I can't do that. I would love to see it, but I can't do that because I know the competition that other vital services also have. And at the moment, if we're putting and go back to national, I know we've veered away from on this one, the country's got a security problem at the moment in the fact that we've got, Russia, Iran and all the rest of it. I think if we suddenly find ourselves with a lot of spare money, we're probably going to have to beef up our defence spending and security spending.
If local journalism is going to survive, we need enough money to keep the lights on. The Bristol Cable has not only managed to survive, but to produce quality journalism which, for almost 10 years, has changed lives across our city. We're looking ahead, hopefully, to another 10 years. To do this, we need members to help us unlock a bonus grant. We're now 55% of the way to £60,000. Head to thebristolcable.org/join to become a member or up your contribution.
So you mentioned potholes, litter, parking, tidy parks, and these are key things that you're kind of leading on. Do you feel that that is an inspiring vision for the city?
No, I mean, we're also leading on additional things as well. So we are talking about house building. We are talking about transport systems. We're talking about the environment. But what we also is a reflection of, you know, the communities we talk about and we represent. We're mounting local election campaigns and local ward campaigns all at the same time. So although we talk about some of the bigger issues on the city, like we want to see increased rail investment, we'd like to see increased park investment, we're also talking about the local side of things, which is actually to get those basics right. But on when I talk about the basics, I mentioned the planning department before. If you don't have a fully functioning planning department, you can't deliver on any of the big things you want to deliver, because a lot of those big ticket items require things like planning officers.
Mm. Presumably, you wouldn't be against, there's been quite a lot of criticism from the one city model, for example, that, you know, being quite cozy with big developers, big business. Presumably, that would be something that you would support.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the one city model is possibly, it's not really very transparent, but I think the idea of getting everyone round the table as a citywide discussion and some of these big players is a genuinely good thing. And I hope it carries on to the next administration, because some of the problems that we want solving can't be solved just by the council. They never could be. Yeah. Absolutely, they never could be. So if you want to discuss homelessness in the city, you want to make sure you're talking to housing providers and other property owners to look at what you could do collectively to do that. If you want to talk about improving provision, sports provision and all that, you want to be talking to the universities about their facilities and schools. So these kind of multi-layered conversations have to happen. And they're a good thing. And I certainly hope they carry on. We'll be pushing for them to carry on.
We spoke about it earlier, particularly in your ward, about cars and bikes. And you've pledged to end the war on motorists. What do you mean by that? That sounds quite emotive. Yeah, I mean, is there really a war on motorists in Bristol?
Well, in my neck of the wood, there's some pretty daft bus lanes coming in that aren't going to help absolutely anybody at all. All they're going to do is increase congestion, which the bus will then get stuck in, along with the drivers. I think all too often they do traffic improvements for the sake of doing an improvement, when actually it's not going to improve anything at all. So you only have to look at putting the bus lane on the dual carriageway in the A418. That's not going to help anyone at all. That's just going to snarl things up. Now, this isn't necessarily about hurting buses or hurting cyclists. Actually, the A418 scheme I mentioned there includes specific standalone cycling provision off the road, which I think is a great idea. So I'm fully supportive of that. So it isn't that we're anti-bike or anti-bus, but we're actually about trying to get the traffic flow through efficiently.
Yeah. Why have you called it a war, though? Why have you called it a war?
Because that's what the council seems to be doing. You only have to look at the clean air zone that cut the portway in half, which actually stops people from the south of Bristol getting jobs in the Avonmouth industrial estate in the north, unless they have a modern car. And these things like putting bus lanes in where they're not needed, etc. So it does feel, for us out here, in Henbury and Brentry, for example, there was one point just before Christmas where there was only one road in and one road out. There's every other bit of road had roadworks on or was just blocked.
Sure. There is, I guess, part of the culture wars, a thing around motorists and cyclists, and which plays out nationally. Do you think you have to be a bit careful sometimes what words you use? Because you don't want to stoke that too much, do you?
I don't think I actually do stoke that at all. I think you have to be careful what you say, but at the same time, I think sometimes people also need to understand that you're using it as an emotive language. But we're not actually about to go to war with anyone over this. You know, there aren't going to be fighter jets in the sky. So I think there's a little understanding of both directions on this.
Yeah. Okay. But you know, obviously that you accept that the words are powerful. And I think that for a sizable amount of people in the city that are pro-cycling, obviously you've had the green surge, which we spoke around. The Labour Party are leaning into more issues, similar things around those neighbourhood schemes in Barton Hill. You've got this national thing around 10-minute cities and all this kind of stuff. That it can be quite toxic, this kind of debate.
It can be, but equally, I'm not trying to be anti-cyclist at all. There are several cycling schemes in my neck of the woods which I wholeheartedly support. I think they'll make the roads a lot safer. But I do think that we have to understand that the suburbs of the city act and think differently from the city centre. You cannot have a 10-minute city or a 10-minute neighbourhood in Brentry. Mm. My ward is two communities very interconnected, so it's Henbury and Brentry. But Brentry itself, if you were in there, it has a doctor's surgery, a scout hut, one primary school and a couple of small shops. There is no way it can access within 10 minutes all the facilities you need to exist on. And there'll be other areas of the city that do the same. So when we hear about people talking about 15-minute or 10-minute neighborhoods, we kind of look at it going, that's impossible.
Yeah, yeah. And it's had quite a lot of pushback anyway, from certainly in Barton Hill and St. George, from local residents.
Well, yeah, I think the problem with liberal neighborhoods is you deflect traffic into other areas, and often those roads are even less able to cope with the traffic than the roads you deflect from.
Reminds me of the ASBOs. I remember when I used to work with young people and young offenders, you'd have these ASBOs that you'd remove young people, you know, from, or gang issues from a certain area, and then it would just go to the area next door. It doesn't really solve anything.
No, it became like a whack-a-mole. Dunk, dunk, dunk. Just pop up to
Do you think the Green Party then are slightly oblivious to the reality of a lot of Bristolians' lives in the city that live on the edge, on the perimeter?
To an extent, I think they're a reflection of a lot of the wards they represent. If you're in the inner city ward, then you're representing communities with a very different composition, different densities. Maybe they can access some facilities, different bus services. Mm. It goes back to that thing, I think, of trying to understand other areas, you know, walk a mile in that shoes kind of job.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But therefore, are you surprised that the Labour Party has gone down that route then, that would pride themselves on being connected to communities that are more isolated, more deprived? And also even the mayoral team, because one of the criticisms of George was that obviously when everyone was bike, he was very much a sort of green activist and didn't really understand, you know, trying to bring in all these different parking schemes, and the Labour were really critical of him, and we're going to honour real local people. And they've sort of gone along the same kind of line, really.
Yeah, a little bit, but it's the choice they made, I suppose.
Is that reacting to the green surge a bit, though, Mark, do you think?
Earlier on, you talked about the Conservatives looking at the Reform Party, right? Mm. I think in Bristol, Labour are looking at the Green Party eating to their left flank. And I think that has happened. We'll have to monitor, they'll have to see how that fares for them in the elections coming forward. All we can do, and we're going to keep trying to do, is to represent our communities as best we can. We're going to do what we can to try and understand other communities, and other councillors, even if we don't agree with them. I do like to try and work out where they're coming from, so I know logically where they got to on it. But actually, in local politics, often what we find is the end result might well be the same. We all want certain things, improve parks, whatever else. The journey to get there might be different, but that's that common ground I mentioned at the beginning. We'll see what we can do. Mm.
Yeah. Do you see Bristol as being a bit of a tale of two cities at times?
I think it's a tale of about three or four cities at times, if we're honest about it.
Okay, expand on that.
What I mean is there are very different areas of the city think and act very differently to other areas. You only have to look at the like Clifton's and compare them to Henbury's, or Avonmouth to Knowle or Bedminster. The city is lovely. It's beautiful. It's diverse. It's got all kinds of different communities, people all over the place, and they do think and act differently. So I don't think it's a tale of two cities. I think it's a tale of several cities.
Yeah. So somebody once said to me, Bristol's a series of villages.
Yeah.
They don't always talk to each other.
Yeah. But actually, that's probably even more true the further out you go. I'm obviously a councillor for North Bristol, but, you know, before World War, I think Westbury-on-Trim Village was brought into Bristol in the 30s. And then obviously it went out to Henbury and Brentry and Avonmouth.
Yeah.
So actually, certainly in the north, it did expand and take in the old historic villages. So yes, I think actually that's probably a good way to describe it. Mm. We're a confederation of villages.
And I think that makes it harder, doesn't it, for a committee system? Because if you are a councillor in Ashley Ward or you're a councillor in Easton, that's incredibly different, and the needs of local residents to Henbury or to Hartcliffe. It's going to be quite tricky how, when we move into this committee system after May, how we kind of make this work a little bit.
It is, but actually I still think that can happen. So if you're a resident in Easton or you're a resident in Henbury, you're still going to want certain things to happen. You're still going to want potholes repaired. You still want your parks improved. You still want your weeds killed. You still want all manner of park improvements, whatever it is. Well, what councillors are going to need to do is try and find that common ground where we agree with each other and try and deliver that. But also sometimes try and work on the fact that sometimes a priority for the city isn't necessarily a priority for your ward. And that does sometimes happen. So I would say, for example, building the Henry Loop rail system, that actually will cut congestion in the inner city. So although it may not be a priority for someone living in St. Paul's, actually, by reducing the amount of cars going on roads in St. Paul's, you will benefit them down the line. So it's about having those kind of conversations.
Western Harbour was a bit like that, how they consulted a range of people, because lots of the consultation was initially with local residents. And that was a similar argument that was made why they went out wider across the city, was that, well, actually, this is going to affect everybody when they come into that area. So sometimes I guess it's a weighing up what local needs are to the wider city and when you need to push something or push back.
Yeah, and Western Harbour possibly is a good example, because strategically, there's a lot to be said for doing it. We just have to do it right and try and dig people with us. So we're going to see how that translates. But yeah, you do need to have those conversations about strategic and local and where the bite is. But trying to understand how colleagues on the council or local residents think and operate, even if it's very different to how you think and operate, I think is important. You have to try and work out where they're coming from.
Do you think politics in Bristol is full of cronyism?
Not necessarily. It's a bit of a weird one, because actually, when in politics, you have friends, and often you will, you know, like if you're trying to recruit candidates, whatever, you'll go to people you know and stand by that. I don't necessarily think it's cronyistic or anything like that.
That's the charge that's been put a little bit against one city and the mayor, is that it's like favours for friends, and certain organisations get pushed, others don't, and there's been a pushback from people about that.
Yeah, that does happen. And I can certainly see the arguments of why that's happened. I think politicians have to be very careful in the way they conduct themselves to try and avoid that. But one of the things is, when you talk about like the one city and all the rest of it, you talk about the heads of the universities or the heads of the zoo or the heads of these big organizations, they will meet and chat with each other an awful lot, because their activities will cross over with each other. So it isn't necessarily that they're all cronies of each other, but they will meet each other and have those conversations a lot, because they're moving in the same circles, trying to do roughly the same things. So the accusation can be leveled at them, but I'm not necessarily sure that it's fully deserved, because sometimes it's just them doing their job.
Just the nature. I mean, and I guess that's the same argument that some people that accept the reality of the merchant venturer's role in Bristol, where there are campaigners that want them to be removed or disband. They have an influence on one city, influence on different committees involved and stuff in the city. But if they were removed, groups of business people are always going to get together and communicate and talk in any other forum, aren't they?
They completely are. And business people will get together and chat. Unions will get together and chat. Campaign groups will get together and chat, just because they're moving in the same circles. I don't think Bristol is cronyistic. I think it can happen. And I think you have to be aware of it. But oftentimes, I say it's just people trying to get on and do their jobs.
Sure. So you've got, at the moment, is it 14 councillors?
Yeah, 20% of the council.
What's the target, Mark? What does good look like for the election?
70, of course.
That's the hope again, isn't it? Yeah, go on. What do you think?
I'm not going to put a number on it. I think that's a mud's game. We're going to be out there, as we are now, trying to make the argument that actually we are good, hardworking local councillors, good, hardworking local candidates, and we're going to try and earn every vote we can.
And is there a strategy to, and I know this happens a lot in election campaigns, targeting certain seats that you think you can win, that are swing seats, not really bothering with some that you think you've got no chance in, doubling down on some of the ones that you want to retain? What's the kind of plan?
There will no doubt be a campaign plan, and there is a campaign plan. But forgive me for saying that. I'm not going to be discussing it on your show.
I thought I'd try my hand.
Good luck, though.
Thank you. Are you the person that's leading on that? Or have you got like a Peter Mandelson, sort of Dominic Cummings type character in the background that's
maneuvering?
One of the voices. Okay. Yeah. So I would say, there are certain people that I would say are puppet masters in the Green Party, the Labour Party, even the Lib Dems, actually. Who would be a puppet master in the local Bristol Conservative Party?
I think you'll find we're all a wonderfully happy, consensual party.
Really?
And I'm not about to say...
Not like the National Party, then, though. Yeah.
Well, go on, then. Who do you think our puppet master is? I'll be the journalist.
I think it's probably Richard Eddy.
Okay, fair enough.
Maybe.
No, well, that's you. I'm just curious.
To be honest, it's not. I don't. To be honest, I don't really know.
I'm going to phone Richard in a minute.
Tell him. Yeah, I definitely think in the Green Party it's Tony Dyer. I definitely think in Labour it was Kevin Slocum. It's not now, so I probably think maybe, and it would have been Helen Holland, I guess. I'm not quite sure who it will be now in the background.
I genuinely actually don't think the Conservatives have a puppet master in Bristol.
Well, maybe you need one. Maybe this is the problem. This is why you've only got 14 councillors. Maybe you could double it if you get a top-level strategist.
We'll just enjoy the lively debate.
Yeah. How long are you going to keep doing it for, then, Mark? Are you going to be doing this forever?
How long I'm here is entirely the choice of Henry Branchy residents. It's an honour and a privilege to have been their councillor for 18 years. It's up to them how long I'm in position.
Sure. Last thing I want to talk about, it is a role that the Conservatives do hold in the region, is Police Crime Commissioner, Mark Shelford. We've obviously had, and I know this is something you're interested in, I think you were part of the committee on this, or you were until recently on
I came off in 2021, I think.
2021. So you have some experience in this field. My background is in, if you don't know, people who listen to this show regularly will know, is in youth offending before going into journalism. There's obviously been a spate and a wave of stabbings and unfortunate incidents and deaths in the city in the last sort of 18 months. What will the Conservatives do to try and get on top of this?
You probably better off asking Mark directly on that. I don't know, talk from my own perspective. I think each one of them is absolutely tragic. And I think it is hard. And I say it because obviously I've got a teenage child at the moment. And the thought of that they go out and don't come back is terrifying, keeps you up at night. I think it's trying to work with the community so that the community is often, they don't view the police as a negative. So try and get the community and the police working together, but also try and bring in other agencies as well so that we're reaching out. So we're trying to break some of the potential gang culture that comes along. Why do people carry knives when they don't need to? They think they're carrying it for protection, but actually all it does is it escalates a literal arms race that could lead to death. So it's trying to break that cycle, trying to understand again where people are coming from on it. I think it would be good if we can get increased CCTV in some more public areas so that we can monitor where these potential problems are. One good campaign I'd love to see out is we spend a lot of time, for example, rolling out defibrillator kits across the city. Can we get bleed kits out there quicker? I know that's dealing with the aftermath of it, but I think that'll be a very worthy cause. I think I'm sure there'll be a lot of businesses prepared to support that as well. There isn't a single, for want of a better term, silver bullet that's going to solve this. I think it's everyone, community, police, action groups, businesses, it's the council, it's everyone pulling together, trying to get on top of this, trying to get knives off the streets.
Why do you think there has been a surge in recent times?
I mean, I don't know the honest answer on that one. Mm. I think people are carrying knives because they want to feel safe. It makes them feel bigger and tougher. But actually, I think it's quite the reverse. I think it's a sign of weakness. But we need to try and get them away. So
are the parties on? Sorry to jump in, Mark. Are the parties on board with this? Because I think, philosophically or ideologically, I think generally, and it's a generalisation, but generally the Tories would be seen as being a bit more tougher on law and order and coming down on that. And I know obviously Mark is an ex-military man and he's a police crime commissioner. He's talking to a Labour mayor that's talking to now a committee system with Green Party. Is that, are people on the same page as to what the causes and the potential solutions to this challenge are?
I think so, to a broad extent. It will alter slightly thing between the parties. I think there's got to be multifaceted. So you're going to need to make sure that for those that carry knives and perpetrate it, that there is tough sentencing and there's a deterrent there that they are dealt with appropriately. But actually, the best thing we can do is to try and stop them happening to begin with. And that's where you actually need to start having the community, police, council, residents, actors, all pulling together so that the knives don't even get on the streets to begin with. It's having the deterrent, but also the intervention to try and make sure this works. And quite where the weight of those two arguments or things fall depends on the parties. But overall, they'll be talking about deterrent and intervention, I think.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. I chaired a debate at the cathedral about this, which had representation from different political parties there. And I did try and raise that question around, and this is coming from somebody who's worked in that field, raise the question around sentencing. for possession, which for those that don't know, if you're possession of a gun is a minimum 10-year sentence. For somebody with a knife, is a minimum of 6 months. And it's like, and the knives young people carry these days are sadly very different. And huge machetes and zombie knives, which are a lot bigger, and a single stab wound can be fatal.
Yeah,
which is very different
serrated,
than probably
the tear.
It is serrated, yeah, all of that. So it was very different than the knives that people would carry when I was younger. And actually, do we need to revisit that? And people shied away from that and very much wanted to talk about the early intervention and youth work and services, and which is critically important. But I couldn't help thinking that I tried to bring it back. People tried to veer the conversation away from that there were some members of family victims in the crowd, and I knew that. And I wonder how they felt, because actually that stuff's great. But if you've lost a child to this,
yeah,
you want some action, don't you? You want.
I think you have to. The perpetrator has to be dealt with robustly. Absolutely, because there has to be deterrent in there. You need to do the intervention work before it. Absolutely. I think the two strands is the intervention, but also the deterrent, and they've both got to be done.
Have we been a bit soft then? I mean, that would be the charge, isn't it? There's a lot of criticism that Sadiq Khan gets in London. Obviously, you know, in London, it's on another level to Bristol, that we've been a bit soft on crime, particularly young offenders, and we've not really taken on the challenge. And maybe we need to reinstill a bit of old-fashioned law and order.
Yeah, I would think we probably do need to revisit that, but it has to be the multi-prong. It has to be both deterrent and intervention. Neither one will work without the other one. And so it has to be both that we have to do.
Cuts to police services haven't helped that, though.
I mean, at the moment, thankfully, a market has actually expanded, so we are recruiting more police onto the streets at the moment. And I'm always a big fan of neighborhood policing. I think actually where you have a neighborhood beat team that know the communities, that are working in the schools or working with people, I think that's the important way to do it. So I certainly hope the mark gets back in. I'll be voting that way. But I want to see that kind of street intervention for the police. And I want the people to look at the police as a friend and an ally they can go to when they have intelligence, when there is an issue that can be reported. That's certainly what
there's still an issue around perception and relationship and trust. And I don't know if you watched the Catch a Copper Channel 4 series, which was recently out. Sarah Crowe was on there, and it was around if the police aren't willing to investigate their own institutional issues and problems and some of their own staff, then people aren't going to trust them to do that to the local community.
Yeah, I mean, on the whole, though, I think the police do, you talk about a thankless task earlier, but it is a bit of a thankless task. And I do think on the whole, they do their very best. I have the utmost respect for them. Sometimes it gets wrong. And at that point, yes, investigation should run its course. But I think they do good work under very challenging circumstances on the whole.
What about the protest in Bristol in the city? You know, obviously that was a national story. Depending on who you talk to, there is a sort of attitude a little bit. I do a lot of work outside the city and talk to other journalists and stuff. And there is a sort of perception that maybe Bristol is a sort of city where everyone's allowed to protest about everything every weekend. And it's a slightly lawless place where people can pull down statues and people can set fire to police vans. And this would be clamped down on in other cities in a more thorough and robust way.
I think the incidents you're referring to are a couple of years ago rather than recently. I think freedom of protest is absolutely essential to any democracy. For those of us living in the outer suburbs of the city, to know that on a Saturday, there's no point trying to get to Cabot Circus because you simply can't get there. I don't think that helps anyone in the end. And actually, certainly for my community, we all go to Cribbs Causeway because actually we can get there.
So not many people from Brentry are going in to protest?
Well, they might. I think the problem with some of these marches and some of the protests is they're happening so frequently that actually your target audience, people you're trying to reach, are starting to turn off a little. And I think that's part of the problem that they've got. But also, it does stop people moving around the city. But having said that, people have a right to protest. Whether I like it or not, they have a right to protest.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the issue why they were protesting, wasn't it? It was around changes actually to what you can and cannot protest and how you can protest. There's been a bit of a...
Wow, you really are dipping into the history. That was last year.
Yeah, it was. But I think there was a recent case actually where one of the protesters was sent down or had a case reviewed, which is why it's popped up into the media recently.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's like the Stop Oil protesters that pop up and try to stop all the traffic. You may have a right to protest, but you don't have a right to totally ruin the lives of everyone else around you. That's not how this works. So if you're going to bring, like London was last year with the stock of oil and all the rest of it, if you're going to try and bring it to a grinding standstill, actually that's public nuisance rather than protest. You can do this once, absolutely make your point, fair enough. But when you're climbing on top of a train and gluing yourself to the roof,
I suppose they would say, well, you know, we're heading to catastrophe, the world's going to end unless we do drastic measures and actually interrupt everyone's day-to-day life, then no one's going to pay attention to what we're doing.
Yeah, and I suspect what actually happened there was they turned off 99% of people that witnessed their work.
Well, I was going to say that is actually how much of a sort of, I interviewed actually somebody from Just Stop Oil on this show, funny enough, and also one of the doctors that protest part of the same organisations who was arrested. And I put that to them as well, just said that, is that not just a sort of PR own goal that you're effectively, the Derry people
you should be... Wasn't there a case where there's a guy couldn't get to hospital and his mother died or something, I think?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's going to turn people against, you. And I said, and so I get what you mean. And I think you are reflecting, and it's good for the cable audience to hear this because they are, I would say, you know, I'm generalizing, but they would be quite, it's quite inner city sort of protest people that would be quite heavily involved in that. But what you're really reflecting is an opinion that I would hear from a lot of people from outside that space, which is that
suburbs,
these idiots, stop, I can't get to work.
I would never call them idiots.
No.
Not publicly.
Not putting words in your mouth. But that's what I would hear. I didn't say you did. That's what people would say that. Or would feel just they're not really winning people over. And I put it to this doctor, that these people aren't responsible, are they? Why are you not specifically going for the oil companies and stuff like that? Why aren't you stood outside? And he said, we do. But the media aren't interested in that. Whereas if you go and do that in the middle of the M32, everyone will arrive with their cameras and,
yeah,
and,
but
and
stuff. Like
and I wonder whether I'm digging out my own game, which is actually whether we're partly responsible for that because we react to the shock and all the drama.
No, the thing is, if you're suddenly starting to block motorway, yeah, you're going to get some news coverage. But actually also what you're doing is you're stopping parents picking up kids. You're stopping people getting to work. You're stopping nurses getting to work. You know, your right to protest, fine, but you don't have a right to make an absolute misery of everyone else's life.
Yeah. The conversation, if you were to have knock on the door in most of the places in Brentry and Henbury and had this conversation around Colson statue being pulled down, Greta Thunberg when she came. I am going back. It's still in modern history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Kill the Bill protest, all this sort of stuff. Now the Palestinian protest, whatever that is. What do you think the reaction would be?
Well, I think there's, first of all, there's a difference between protesting during rush hour traffic on a Monday morning and protesting on Saturday when a lot of people aren't in work. Not everyone. There's still nurses to get to hospitals, doctors and things. But there is a difference between the two. And if people want to protest, they have a right to protest.
No, that's you, though. I'm not asking you. I'm asking, what do you think residents, working class residents of Brentford, if you went along, I don't know, of Henbury, if you went along Crow Lane, you started knocking on doors and you asked people, what do you think about all these people protesting in town?
I think their view on the protest would depend entirely on what protest is actually happening at the time, whether they support the goal. So yeah, I can't put
what sort of goals would they support? What sort of goals would they support?
Well, I'm hoping Everton surviving in the Premier League, but I'm not necessarily sure that
you can't defuse this with humour. That's what I do.
Oh, okay, we're
answering the question. Yeah, I guess the reason why I asked those questions, joking aside, is because I think there is a bit of a, whilst there is a social and economic divide a little bit in the city. I think the life expectancy gap is about 12 years, depending on which part of the city you're in. I'm finding increasingly there is a bit of a cultural gap in the city where more people that come in, we've got more students than, you know, ever before, and students themselves, politically, I'm generalising, but tend to, you know, be more interested in protests. The younger you are, lean a bit more left. You've got more people coming in because Bristol's been put on the map for this type of stuff. And juxtaposition to that, people from the outer ring sometimes feel that their city is changing and the type of people they see when they go to the centre has changed in such a way that it's not recognisable from what it used to be before. And their values and what they feel and they think is very different than those people. And I don't know whether you see that yourself.
I think we go back to the earlier comment that Bristol's sort of a collection of villages. So the different communities will think differently on it. Henry Brentry isn't a big one on inner city protest, but even in Henry Brentry, when things we don't agree with, we do tend to rally to the flag a little. So when the Lib Dems tried to sell off the parks in 2010, 11, I think it was, there was a citywide petition that got something like 18,000 signatures on it. 4,500 of them came from Henry and Brentry. So Henry Brentry does protest, and you know,
it's just the when those issues are affecting them directly.
It tends to be more on the immediate local issue that the big protests happen in my neck of the woods.
Yeah. Okay, right. I'm going to end on this, a light comic touch, Mark, if I may. You are obviously the leader of the Bristol Conservative Group.
Indeed.
However, yeah, and I hope you're working hard, because you were accused in 2018 by then Labour councillor Fabian Breckles of not working hard enough.
What we did on that one, there's a thing where councillors basically get interviewed by council staff. And then one of the questions is, how many hours does a councillor put in? And now this is actually a private conversation that Fabian knew that and then decided to twist everything, which is slightly naughty of Fabian. But what I was saying is councillors, actually, it's a part-time role. Most councillors have another job that goes with it. And if you're a backbench councillor, then I would expect you to do roughly this many hours. And I went through and explained, it's this on committees, you've probably got this on that, and da-da-da. And then he thought that referred to me, but I'm not a backbench councillor. I'm the leader of my group. I do a darn sight more hours than the one I was talking about. So he totally misrepresented me, I'm afraid. Bit of a character assassination. Anyone would think there was an election coming up at that point.
Yeah. So you refute that, and you are working hard.
Yeah.
Leading from the front. Yeah.
And I would just say, point out that 2018, I have actually been elected since then.
And he stood down, didn't he?
No, he's still around. Fabian's still around.
Is he still a councillor, is he?
So St. George.
I didn't even know that.
Lucas Hill, I think.
That ruined my joke then. I thought he wasn't. I don't know.
He's still around, mate.
He
tried to stick the knife.
And how's the relationship between you both now?
Fine. I may not like it. It is what it is. But I expect it, because it's politics. Yeah. It's the rough and tumble.
Yeah. I got to say, we're going to wrap this up now. You remind me of a seasoned central midfield player that's been around the clock a little bit. That you get kicked a few times, but you just get up and you don't moan. You carry on with the game, and that's just the rules of engagement. And you brush yourself down. They seem very philosophical about
it. I played rugby for too long. I've been kicked in places I'd rather not be.
Oh, were you rugby player? Okay.
Yeah. But in the end, you just get up and carry on playing, because that's the game of rugby.
What position were you?
I was prop, of course.
Oh, you a prop? Oh, what were you going on?
That's the hardest working players on the pitch.
Well, and also the nastiest. Eye gouges, groin strikes, little kind of things to push down to twist people's arms.
Just little acts of random love.
Well, that makes sense. This makes sense now then, doesn't it? That your philosophical nature around the gladiatorial arena of politics and being quite whatever about it, because if you've been in the front row... I have to my sins in my formative days a bit. You know, that's where the real dark arts take place, isn't it? This is a cakewalk. Politics is a cakewalk compared to that.
I don't know. I've never been kicked in those many places. That wasn't.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, thanks ever so much for coming on, Mark. Most appreciated.
No problem.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Feeling confident?
I will know entirely in 16 days.
You will. Yeah.
I will.
Living in hope. Take care. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Many thanks to Mark Weston, the leader of the Bristol Conservatives and councillor for Henbury and Brentry, for joining us on this election special of Bristol Unpacked. I'm Neil Maggs. Big thanks to our production team from the Bristol Cable. Also, Blue Dot for our music.